on today's show.
Islam has its own worldview, and all these things that Christ preached are completely alien. You know, loving your enemy, forgiving them, and all that sort of thing. That doesn't exist. Like I said, it's more visceral. It's more primordial. It's just me against you, which is why it also resonates with a sort of primitive mindset or sort of natural mindset, if you like. And that's why it still thrives all around the world, the Islamic world and non-Islamic world, sort of tribalism, which is seen as morally right. That's one of the chief obstacles, is that just people think religion in general is some power for good, that it's always a divorce from politics and from the real world, that it's something you do internally to make yourself a better person. No, that's, you know, by and large, that has been sort of limited to Christianity.
Stay tuned. Greetings and welcome to the Missions Podcast, the show that explores your hard questions on missions, theology, and practice to help goers think and thinkers go. My name is Alex Kochman, Director of Communications and Engagement with ABWE, joined once again by Scott Dunford, pastor of Western Hills Church in San Mateo, California. And it's good to be here back with you, Scott. We are running without Brian, our producer, today. And so if something is terribly wrong right now, either in the video quality or the audio quality, I have no idea. And it's always a blessing, though, in the life of any ministry, any program, when you can hire people who take things far beyond your initial capacity, and then you step back into it and you realize it's grown beyond the point where you can manage it. I'm so glad that I don't have to produce this anymore. I'm way out of my depth. But Scott, actually, speaking of being out of our depth, we've got an incredible conversation, I think, coming up today. You know, Scott, one of the things that brought you and I together at first was, number one, our affinity for the history of the church, and that's been our theme this year. But then secondly, and more specifically, was our heart to see the Muslim nations of the world come to Christ, and for those lands to be re-evangelized, could even say re-Christianized again. And so I think it's fitting that we dive into those things at length here today with a guest whose work I've read at least two of his books that I can recall and have benefited a lot from them. Scott, would you introduce our guest for us?
Yeah, I mean, before we get into that, you know, just most of us, our introduction to the Crusades is limited to Robin Hood, you know, and probably just the cartoon version. And so we're going to talk about things that are very pertinent, but also going a lot deeper in some of those discussions, and hopefully expanding our mind. But we're talking with Raymond Ibrahim. He's a widely published author and public speaker specializing in the Middle East and Islam. He's got books out there that you should check out: The Defenders of the West, The Sword and the Scimitar, Crucified Again, and the Al-Qaeda Reader. His work has appeared in various publications like the New York Times Syndicate, CNN, and Fox News. He's lectured at universities, briefed governmental agencies, even appeared before Congress, and has a really unique background of being raised in the U.S. by Egyptian parents, being fluent in English and Arabic. And he's very adept, as you're going to find out here in a moment, at explaining the Middle Eastern mindset to Western audiences. He's currently a distinguished senior Shulman Fellow at the Gatestone Institute and the Judith Freeman Rosen Fellow at the Middle Eastern Forum. And so we're really excited to welcome you. Welcome from another Californian at this point. Raymond, welcome to our show. We're glad to have you.
Hello, Scott and Alex. Thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
And also, don't forget your background in bodybuilding as well should be mentioned.
Yeah, well, you and Alex have that in common, I guess. And I'm actually working on it. So believe it or not, I've been to the gym for 2 weeks in a row. So you can start. I guess the three of us are all gym rats.
Yeah, it's very obvious. I can see. Yeah. And I think it's important to exercise both our minds and bodies.
So besides weightlifting, briefly introduce yourself and share a bit about your background, the focus of your work, and particularly your interest in the historical conflicts between Christianity and Islam.
Sure. Well, as you indicated, I was born here by Egyptian parents, Coptic Christian parents from the Middle East. And so that initially, instantly, obviously made me very interested in the Middle East in general, and especially the position of Christians in that region in particular, because that obviously resonates with me and my own background. And I studied it actually a little bit formally, you can say, at college, majoring in history, undergrad and grad. and focused on the Middle East. So the Crusades, and before the Crusades, the battles of the so-called Byzantine or Eastern Roman Empire, and the initial Islamic conquests. My thesis, my MA thesis, was about the first major battle of the Arab conquest in the 7th century. So that's always, you know, been interesting to me. And then after 9/11, that's when I finished my master's degree. I was, maybe even know Victor Davis Hanson. He was my professor at the time, and he's one of people who actually suggested I continue on with college, which I did. I went to Georgetown University in Washington, and then I got a job at the Library of Congress as an Arab language specialist and dealing with various languages, which was, so I got really busy with that, working full time, and I got a major book deal, the Al-Qaeda Reader, because I came across writings in Arabic by Al-Qaeda that had never been translated. So that was my first book. Mm. And, you know, long story short, after about 6-7 years, I resigned from the Library of Congress just to focus exclusively on researching writing, which I've been doing ever since, producing the books that you mentioned. And the top, one of the books, Crucified Again, the subtitle is Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. And that deals with, obviously, the topic of persecution, both from a historical and contemporary point of view. And I've been doing that actually for a long time, because even before that book came out in 2013, I've been compiling reports every month for the Gatestone Institute of Muslim Persecution of Christians that arise every month. And amazingly, you know, I started in 2011, and every single month till now has seen, you know, one or two dozen of egregious Muslim attacks on Christians. You know, the sort that if it was a Christian doing to a Muslim would be all over even the Western media. But you'll never hear about it except from small human rights organizations and foreign media. Yeah, definitely still maintain the interest in that particular topic. And more generally in the history, again, of Islam and Christian interactions. Like I said, that's my main nexus, I suppose. And so, especially as of late, I've been going back to the history in the books that were mentioned, Sword and Scimitar and Defenders of the West, so forth. And I think that's a very important topic as well, because it's so, as you indicated, you know, most people, you know, the Crusades, they know Robin Hood and the Disney version, mm-hmm. you know, with the animals. So I think it's, there's a reason for that, I think. And there's a reason that the Crusades are demonized. And it's basically, you know, logical arguments and conclusions are always, you know, conclusions built on premises. And so that's why, to maintain the narrative that we have today, which is, you know, white Christian evil, everyone else good, you have to subvert the premises, which would be history. And so that's why there's been this ongoing campaign that went on for decades to really demonize not just the Crusades, but really anything where Christians and non-Christians, especially Muslims, interact. And so to some extent, I would say my books and my work since then has been to offer correctives of the actual history that transpired.
Well, one of the things that we talk about in the missions community, obviously, is reaching Muslims. But as soon as we're talking about that, I think we are assuming a lot of Americans are coming in to that conversation just with this sort of default coexist mentality where religion is a category on your Facebook profile. They're not realizing, sure, they know about the Crusades, but they're not even realizing that even prior to the Crusades, Islam was locked in a war with Christianity since its inception. And that was always a core part of its identity. I think what we don't know in terms of the history can cost us. So obviously people can pick up books like Sword and the Scimitar if they want to get more, and we certainly want to point them in that direction. So we're not asking you to spill all of the beans, but give us just sort of an initial foray, an initial introduction to the topic. What does some of those early centuries look like? You know, maybe some of those key conflicts that people today are largely ignorant of, including Christian workers in the Middle East seeking to be the light of Christ. I mean, many of them, again, unfortunately, they don't know the history of how these things developed. So give us just an introduction and a taste of that.
Yeah, sure. Happy to do so. I think that's very important for the reasons you lay out. So the Crusades are in, the first Crusade is called in 1095. Now, before that, and it's unfortunate because whenever you know, the people who like to demonize the Crusades, they often start with the Crusades and they leave a vacuum 4 centuries worth that they don't talk about, where they kind of hint that it was sort of peaceful. John Esposito, a professor at Georgetown University, I think I quote him in Sword and Scimitar, and I'm reminded of this because I requoted that quote. He wrote, four centuries of peace elapsed between the Muslim world and Europe before a papal power play and political maneuver, launched the Crusades. And, you know, all throughout what he says and what so many historians since then have said in academics is that the Crusades had no justification. Muslims were not doing anything wrong. It was just essentially colonialism. That's how it's presented. It's like mm-hmm. first colonial venture of white Christians going to colonize brown peaceful people and commit atrocities against them. So it fits into that paradigm right now. So the history, though, the truth of how we got to the first crusade, it's completely different. In the 7th century, when Islam is essentially born, the traditional year one of Islam is 622. So that's the traditional date. Muhammad's born in 570. But from that point, and after Muhammad dies in 632, Islam basically launched a massive jihad on the lands that surrounded it, almost all of which were Christian. Except the only one that wasn't was Iran, Persia, Zoroastrian, essentially. But every other, all of the Middle East, greater Syria, which encompassed all the modern states of Jordan and Israel and Lebanon and so forth, Egypt, all the way across Western North Africa until you got to Morocco, so Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, et cetera, Asia Minor, what we call today Turkey. Those were actually more Christian than all of Europe. That's the heart of the Christian world was there in the 7th century. And that's why when you talk historically, there's five C's, essentially ecclesiastical centers. One of them is Rome, which we can say is the West. The other four are all in the East. And that would be Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. All of them, of course, fell to Islam. So in the 7th century, you get this massive jihad. And like you said in the book, Sword and Scimitar, I go into the various battles and so forth. But long story short, by 711, you have all of North Africa has been completely conquered, this Christian region. And I think it's important to underscore how Christian North Africa and the Middle East were. This is really, especially Egypt, today when you hear about Egypt, you think it's a Muslim nation. It's the home, it's one of the most sort of organic Muslim nations people think. But really, it was actually one of the fiercest Christian nations, if you really go back into the history. It's the one that produced so many of the early church fathers. It's the one, it's where monasticism was born, under St. Anthony the Great. Mm-hmm. You had the greatest luminaries like Origen and Clement, the chief defender.
Athanasius.
The chief defender of the Nicene Creed, Athanasius. Mm-hmm. Even the heretics came from there, Arian. Arius was an Egyptian as well. So it was, the first parchment of the gospel is found in Egypt. First drawing of Jesus is found, the oldest in Egypt. John Cassian, the European monk who traveled through Egypt in the 5th century, I believe, noted how from top to bottom, all the way up and down the Nile, all he could hear were monks and prayers, because that's exactly how Christian it was. And then Islam came. And so basically, Egypt gets conquered in 640 or 641. And like I said, it's dominoes thereafter. All of North Africa gets conquered. And that's the slow process of the Islamization of the Middle East and North Africa. And these times are full of, the sorts of atrocities that ISIS, the Islamic State, commits, but on an exponential level, because this isn't just some small terrorist group. It's actually the caliphates. It's the entire strength of the Islamic empires that are doing this. So you get all the massacres and crucifixions of Christians and throwing women and children into harems and the rape and the slaughter and the beheadings. All those years and decades up until 711 are just saturated with that sort of behavior, also in greater Syria as well. And then 711, I mentioned that point because that's when Islam enters Europe. Now they're in Spain, which was also, of course, an old Christian nation. And the same sorts of, and they conquer Spain. Many people forget about that. Except for a small, in the northwestern quadrant of the peninsula, you have a small nucleus of resistance that is formed from the remaining Christians. And that's where the Reconquista, the Reconquest, is born, where the Christians, century after century, push southward until they actually reclaim the entire peninsula by 1492. Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Ironically,
and doing so, I understand not to spoiler alert for your book, but doing so in part to actually get in touch with some legendary Christian king who could help them against the Muslims, little known fact. Is that more or less correct?
Well, and not just that. All the early transatlantic voyages from the Portuguese, especially, and the Spaniards were part and parcel of the crusade. They were all about somehow, like you said, either trying to reach Prester John, the sort of mythical king who's supposed to be, you know, living in different regions and who for a time was confused with the Mongols because they converted to Christianity. And he was supposed to be this legendary king, you know, far off somewhere in the east or in the south. Some thought he was in Ethiopia as well, who would, once the Christians of the West could meet him, would call on his aid, and then they would do some sort of pincer movement on Islam in between them. So believe it or not, that's one of, you know, when we hear about spices and Christopher Columbus, that's why he was doing that. No, it was primarily, or it was in the context of this long war with Islam. And the reason they had to go and circumnavigate the globe is because they couldn't take the short land route because they would get killed by the Muslims who ran that region, the Ottomans, and the Mamluks, Egypt, and so forth. So that's why this sort of thing goes on until, let's say, 732. So now we have one century after Muhammad's death. And now the Muslims are in the middle of France at the famous Battle of Tours, where they're actually halted and finally sort of sent back and holed up in Iberia or in Spain. And then during this time, you know, in the 8th century and 9th, the Mediterranean islands are all conquered. And again, the same sorts of atrocities, et cetera, are committed. Now Europe, a lot of historians knew this before, but the so-called Dark Ages, they don't like to use that term anymore, in large measure was because of these Islamic conquests, because they completely separated the sort of younger, more illiterate and more impoverished part of Christendom, which was Europe at the time. They separated from the older Eastern lands. There's a reason that Constantine left Rome and went and created a new capital in the East. That's really where it was. So the Dark Ages come because of this sort of separation where now there's no more continuity between in the Mediterranean, which was awash essentially with jihad. So that's why the Dark Ages in a way descend and literacy's lost, et cetera, et cetera. But then, you know, you move on and now the Turks enter the scene. The Arabs, of course, are the standard bearers and founders of Islam. But now the Turks start pouring in. They become Muslims, they convert, and they take to jihad more than the Arabs did, especially the Ottoman Empire, which was more devoted to the ideals of jihadi principles than actually anyone before them, surprisingly. But perhaps not so surprisingly, because jihadist principles completely comported with their own way of life hitherto, which is essentially tribalism. And this is a whole different thing we can get into. Islam is inherently tribalistic. It deifies tribalism.
Let's talk about that, because I think as moderns, we're tempted to say, you know, there's Islam and then there's Islamic extremism. You know, there's sophisticated Islam and then there's and even that misses the point. Obviously, there are Muslims who are more enculturated into the West and who don't hold to jihadist principles. We have examples of that. But that's missing the point that the ethos, you would say, of Islam. Really, you know, we talk about culture all the time on a show like this. It really is simply just born out of the cultural waters of tribalism that it was in at the time. And it's sort of copied and pasted that onto wherever it spread. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. And I'll address that more elaborately, but I'm just going to finish off what I was saying because I'm almost at the Crusades. And that's what I was trying to build up to. So now it's about it's the 11th century. Now it's early 1000s. Year 1000 or so forth, and the Turks start running amok all throughout the Holy Land, doing the same sorts of things, slaughtering and killing Christians, burning churches under one caliph. He's not even a Turk, but also in the 11th century, he's an Egyptian caliph. According to Muslim sources, 30,000 churches were destroyed in Egypt and Syria, which again underscore how Christian that region was. And this is right around, I think, 1035 AD. So you see, we're getting close to the Crusades now. And in fact, a crusade was called a proto-crusade by the Pope because of that. And they destroyed the Holy Sepulchre, which was built atop where Christ was resurrected, etc. But it came to nothing, that proto-crusade. And then by 1071, the Battle of Manzikert, Asia Minor is completely overrun. And of course, that's one of the oldest Christian regions where St. Paul sent many of his epistles. And the Armenians, you know, we talk about the Armenian genocide from about a century ago. It actually started a millennium ago at the hands of Muslim Turks, who are also justifying it through jihadist rationale. And, you know, again, the sources talk of tens of thousands of Christians tortured, killed, churches burned, and so forth. And that is the true context of the First Crusade, because then the Emperor of the East, Alexius, called on the Pope and just said, look, you know, we've lost all of Asia Minor. They're now at the footsteps of Constantinople. They're going to be in Europe soon. And what was happening in the Holy Land, European pilgrims were being molested and killed and destroyed. So that is, therein lies the First Crusade. That's the rationale that was used. It was to help Eastern Christians and to liberate the Holy Land from what Muslims had been doing, which we, of course, never hear. And we can get back to all that. But as to your question about Islam today, and, you know, I think the best way to put it is you're basically asking what's the difference between moderate and radical Islam. I think that's the dichotomy we're often presented with, as if it's a real dichotomy. And there is no difference. Okay, Islam is Islam. Islam is very black and white, more so than most religions. It's very legalistic. It's about what you do and what you don't do. And there's large consensus in regards to many of these things. And it's, when I say it's tribalistic, and it's tribalism deified. What I mean by that is Muhammad, born in the 6th century, as an Arabian. Okay, he's born in a very tribalistic society, obviously. And what he did is he took all the tribalistic mores, but re-articulated them in a theology. Okay, so now, tribalism is us against them. Anything we do is right. Anything they do is wrong. You know, that's how it is. So here you have, you know, we, the Muslims, are the true people of God. And then everyone else, the infidel or the kafir, in Arabic, is the enemy, de facto enemy. It is our job to fight them, to subjugate them, to kill them. We can plunder them, enslave them, rape them, do whatever we want, because they are the enemy. Okay. And then, of course, there are certain rules and so forth. The Quran 9:29 says, fight the people of the book, which means Christians and Jews, people who have scriptures, until they pay tribute and feel themselves humbled. Okay. So that was, you know, reserved, let's say, for the people of the book. But they still have to know their place, essentially. They live like second-class citizens. And that still goes on till today, even though, you know, they have sort of modern constitutions. It still goes on, and everyone, it's sort of accepted in society. The authorities look the other way. So it's tribalism, and it became very appealing to tribalistic people. That's why if you look at all the large segments of peoples who converted to Islam historically, they were all originally tribal, much different than Christianity, which is sort of sedentary civilized civilizations that became Christian. So you have the Arabs, you got the Berbers in North Africa, you have the Turks, as I mentioned. Then you have the Tatars or Mongols who became Islamic. So because it all comported with their own way of life, which is, you know, the enemy, just the other exists for me to prey on. That's it. And that's legal. That's praiseworthy. Now in Islam, it's good. It's not just some neutral thing, a way of making a life or a living. You're actually going to go to heaven now by killing the enemy. So that never changed. That was never jettisoned. Islam never reformed and said, hey, the violent tribalistic aspects we're going to get rid of, or we're going to reinterpret. That's never happened. I mean, once in a while, you get an American Muslim who makes a lot of noise and says he's going to reform Islam and he understands the Quran verse differently, but good for him. But 99.99% of the Muslim world doesn't know him or care or even follow him. And if they did, and if he was in the Middle East, he might, you know, pay for it, for his heresy. So Islam, so when you get a moderate Muslim is all a moderate Muslim is, and they do exist, though I take some umbrage at the term moderate, it's not accurate. All a moderate Muslim is someone who just doesn't follow the strict guidelines of Islam. You can see that obviously Christians can be in that, you know, category. Just because a guy's named Muhammad doesn't mean he believes or is practicing the things that I just delineated, obviously.
Right.
But the ones that do, I don't see how they're radical. They're just observant Muslims. Okay. So I think the true distinction is observant Muslims and nonchalant Muslims. That's the true distinction. It's not radical and it's not moderate. And obviously, but that's not how it's presented, because if you present it that way, you are essentially implicating the religion itself. And nobody wants to do that. No one wants to say that Islam itself is inherently whatever, violent, intolerant, et cetera, misogynistic. So they come up with this idea, radical, as if these groups of Muslims have sort of really pulled it out of context to come up with some crazy interpretation. They haven't. ISIS, the Islamic State, the sort of Islam that they implemented is straight out of the books. The history of Islam, as I have in both Sword and Scimitar and Defenders of the West, you're going to find the Muslims all acting like ISIS. In fact, ISIS acts that way because it intentionally patterns itself after historic Islam. You know, so that there it is. But there's a lot of, you know, deception and gaslighting, as it were, about what Islam is and why Muslims are upset. I mean, up till now, because, you know, going back to the Crusades and the ignorance surrounding it, you actually have intelligent people and academics who say Muslims are angry because of the Crusades. They have a grievance because of the Crusades that they still are holding on to, which is so beyond absurd.
Let's dive into that a little bit, because I think that's a good transition point, because clearly we've all heard that. We've heard it from the media, but then even in conversations with Muslims, that'll sometimes come up, because I think that's just become the standard accepted understanding, is like, wow, these Western Christians invaded Muslim lands and completely ignorant, either ignorant or just willfully manipulating history to say, to forget the fact that no, actually it was a reconquest of lands that were followers of Christ at that time. So, but all this sets up what's going on currently in current events, but especially relationships between Christians and Muslims. So maybe just as concisely as you can, how do all these historical conflicts shape what's happening now, the relationship between Christianity and Islam, especially if you can dive into like mutual perceptions and interactions? Like, how is what's happened in the past shaping what we're dealing with right now?
And before you do so as well, if I could just get in one comment, we commented just very briefly on how in the West we use these categories of radical, moderate, etc. You know, we have this baseline disposition that, well, just everyone wants to be peaceful and tolerant just as we do. And real quick, just from a fundamental presuppositional note, I think it's important to note that the reason why we have this baseline commitment to tolerance is because of Christendom, is because of the influence of Christ upon our society and our psychology and our philosophy of how to do civilization. And we're at a point now, though, where we deny those Christian roots, that Christian heritage, but we want the fruit without the root. And so we abstract this thing called religion. We put Christianity, Islam, any other religion on equal footing. And we say, well, surely all of these other abstract religious systems share this same baseline commitment to peaceful coexistence that we all do as a part of this order. And that's just not the case. But it is just interesting that all of this is actually the result of how the gospel's penetrated our thinking. The fact that we assume those things, unfortunately, we assume them to our detriment, and we assume them naively. But please comment on that, Raymond, because I do want to hear. I found that interesting, that observation.
No, I completely agree with you. I've actually spoken about this many times, what you just said, which is basically, you know, all the things that, you know, the so-called left, and I hate that term, you know, it's why I hate it, but let's use it for convenience sake, believe in, okay, which is, you know, or claim they believe in, you know, human rights, equality, and all that. That comes directly from Christianity. That wasn't born in a vacuum. That's not a product of the Enlightenment as much as they'd like to think. And even if it is, it's because it comes from Christianity, which preceded the Enlightenment and which informed many Enlightened thinkers as well. Okay, so these ideas, you know, of tolerance and love and mercy and so forth were completely alien until Jesus Christ said them and Christianity came into being. But it's so taken for granted now that, like you said, people think that everyone is like that. Everyone believes in these same precepts. That's just not the case at all. Okay. And that's also why the so-called left is losing that sort of thing, because they've also lost Christ. They've turned away from the entire message. Okay. And you can't just pick and choose and take this and forget about that. And that's the point with Islam. Islam has its own worldview, and all these things that Christ preached are completely alien. You know, loving your enemy, forgiving them, and all that sort of thing. That doesn't exist. Like I said, it's more visceral. It's more primordial. It's just me against you. Okay. It's very primitive. And which is why it also resonates with a sort of primitive mindset or sort of natural mindset, if you like. And that's why it still thrives all around the world, Islamic world and non-Islamic world, sort of tribalism, which is seen as morally right So yeah, I definitely agree that that's one of the chief obstacles, is that just people think religion in general is some power for good, that it's always a divorce from politics and from the real world, that it's something you do internally to make yourself a better person. You know, no, that's, you know, by and large, that has been sort of limited to Christianity. But Islam is a very different manifestation, how it happens. It's more, like I said, it's social. Islam is about an order. And that's why, you know, the Islamic State is a very old Islamic concept that, you know, begins with Muhammad himself. A lot of Westerners are just projecting, you know, they've universalized Christian virtues, thought that they can exist without Christianity. And now they're projecting it onto all peoples and saying that all peoples want to live this way. And it's just wrong. Mm. As for Scott, your question that you were asking earlier, I think I usually answer it by discussing the difference between, I call it, you know, continuity versus confusion. Yeah, I think you were asking me how Muslims and Westerners understand this long history and how it affects them today and how it all shapes up. And basically for Muslims, it's continuity. They still see the same thing. The Christian West, the infidel is the enemy, okay? And you're supposed to subjugate and take advantage of the enemy any which way you can, including in certain cases through stealth and clandestinely and by deception. And I think that's sort of the phase we're in right now. You know, for a Muslim, for example, to disavow or denounce Muhammad and Islam and say, I'm a Christian, and convert and, you know, get baptized and do all that sort of thing, it's actually Islamic for them to do that. Islam advocates that, as long as it's for a stratagem against the Christian and they keep their Islam in their heart and they actually work towards that. So during the Reconquista in Spain, for example, after Islam became weakened up, you know, for centuries, it was the aggressor and it was in control. But when it was finally confined to Granada, small southern tip of Spain, and, you know, the Christians had completely won, they allowed them to be Muslim and keep their religion and enforce Sharia on themselves. But then they noticed that so long as they were Muslim, they hated the Christians. And whenever it was possible, they would launch some sort of insurrection that was pretty violent. And they would conspire with the Ottomans and the pirates, Barbary pirates, fellow Muslims, and so forth. So it came down to you either convert and become Christian or you leave. Nowadays, it's presented as, you know, as a reflection of how backwards the church was, Spanish Catholics were, that they're just, you know, forcing people into the religion. No, the truth is they wanted them to convert to Christianity because that was seen as the only way that they could slough off their Islamic tribalism and become one of us and therefore not hate and try to subjugate us. Mm. And the Muslims, half a million, got a fatwa saying, yeah, you can convert, you can get baptized, you can, you know, partake of the Eucharist, and go to church every day, and but you have to keep your heart true Islam and hate for the infidel. And that's what half a million did. And it went on for generation to generation, where these Muslims would go to church, then they would come home and preach jihad to their children. Okay, and this went on generation after generation, to the point that I quote one Spaniard saying they were better Christians than us, but at home they were still jihadists. I tell you all this long bit of history because I think that's the that's very applicable today, where you have a lot of Muslims who will play the game and tell you I'm moderate. Okay. And I think there are moderates, but they're just lackadaisical. But some will play the game consciously and, you know, disavow violence and so forth. But if and when the time is opportune, I think they'll change their tune. As far as the West, that's the confusion. So there's continuity with the Muslims insofar as how they see and treat the West. And as far as the confusion, the West is pure confusion. There's become a complete break with how Westerners and Europeans and Christians understood Islam historically, which was basically, you know, what I'm saying, or think of what the worst Islamophobe would say. That's basically what the popes were saying for centuries. So, but today, all of that, I think, has been jettisoned and removed and intentionally wiped out to make way for these new ideas, okay, whatever, which is all religions are equal, multiculturalism, relativism, you know, all that sort of thing is taking place, which has caused Western European nations to completely forget and even be apologetic for what they did vis-a-vis Muslims historically. And that's why it's interesting if you look at a lot of these, you know, Western nations, they have huge Muslim populations who are acting the same way as their forebears did, by the way. If you look at a country like Sweden, I mean, portions of it are about to collapse just from the Muslim migrants who are all committed to criminality. Same thing in all these major cities that the number one newborn baby name is Muhammad, okay, in Oslo, in Amsterdam, Brussels, I think in Vienna. So that's the difference. Okay, continuity. Muslims see it and are still acting the same way, but they're weak. And Westerners are strong, but they don't see it that way. And they've canceled off all grudges or whatever and are trying to start anew. But it's just not really working.
I want to repeat that because that's such a helpful piece of analysis. The West has never been stronger militarily, but we are forgetful of the history. And of course, we're weak spiritually. Islam is very, very much in touch with its history and aware of the continuity of history, and yet is itself weak militarily, culturally, and in other ways. That is a helpful contrast there. I'm thinking about takeaways, and we are largely speaking to people in the missions community here. There's two takeaways that come to mind for me, and I want to hear what both of you gentlemen would have to say, but of course, especially our guest. First, reading some of your work, thinking about the history of even these conflicts, there is an incredible toughness on the part of the Christians. We know that going back pre-industrial revolution, pre-air conditioning, obviously people were tougher. But it's beyond that. The things that some of these men in battle endured is truly astonishing. I mean, they're giants among men. And I'd be curious to hear you share one or two of those stories, because even though we don't find ourselves, although there are armed conflicts around the world, obviously, for us as Christians in missions, we're largely talking about a spiritual battle, a moral battle, and sometimes a battle against ourselves and our own love of ease and comfort. And yet there's so much that we can learn there just from their simple toughness. Can you just share a little bit and give our viewers and listeners a taste of that?
Yeah, I mean, these men, they were, first of all, most of them, a lot of, commoners and peasants, oftentimes, of course, made all the ranks of the army. But the kings themselves and the emperors and the highest nobles all committed, a lot of them committed themselves to the Crusades, and to the point that they actually would die or lose their kingdoms. And they knew it. It was a risk worth taking for them. And they were in the thick of the fray, fighting. I mean, these weren't the sort of stereotypical kings who just sit home and, entertain themselves. And they were actually there. So they were definitely manly in that sense. And I think, if you want, we can discuss, various profiles. But King Louis or Saint Louis comes to mind. Louis the Ninth, of course, is one of them. But all the other ones and their and the money they would put up, their own money, just to defend other Christians and so forth. But I think the crux of the matter, why there were so many of those Christians back then, whereas there aren't now, actually is a theological or doctrinal point, which is back then, no Christian had a problem with the concept of just war. If you're the aggressor, if you're the evildoer, then you can be resisted up to death and violence. And this was articulated, by people like St. Augustine, of course. He's very famous for this. And they would cite things from scriptures, such as St. John, when soldiers came up to him, John the Baptist, to be baptized. And they said, what must we do? And what he told them was, he didn't tell them, leave the army. Same thing with Jesus, the man that he was very impressed with, a centurion, man of great faith, such as none in Israel had. Well, he was the head of an army that was definitely killing, and he himself was ordering, the killing of people and probably doing it with his own hand. And Jesus, who often when he commits a miracle, performs a miracle, tells people to repent. But he didn't say that to this centurion. So there's a lot of implicit support, right, we've seen in the New Testament for this idea. And like I said, by and large, the majority of Christians in the pre-modern era had no problem with it. But I think somewhere or other, the idea came that, okay, it's all about turning the other cheek, loving your neighbor, and essentially becoming a doormat. And while obviously turning the other cheek and loving your neighbor, all that, or your enemy, and praying for them, is all legitimate and is all in the Bible, it's not, I don't think it's balanced anymore. And I think this is by design and it's intentional. I think there are non-Christians who hate Christianity, who have wormed their way into Christianity, and who have presented Christianity as that is where it begins and ends. And it begins and ends with tolerance, foot washing, and closing your mouth. And if you do anything, certainly anything violent, I don't care if it's in defense, you're not a real Christian. So I think that kind of idea has really taken root, though it's not essentially or inherently, wasn't understood that way by over a millennium of Christians. But I think it's really taken root and grown. And in a way, it's also for some Christians, it's a way of making a virtue of a vice or cowardice and laziness. It's obviously a lot easier not to take up the fight, the good fight, and say, because I don't believe in violence. All right. But when you see when they saw what was happening to fellow Christians, to Christian churches and so forth, the destruction, they couldn't say, well, we're going to turn. I mean, if you take that principle of turning the other cheek and not fighting back to its logical course, Christianity would have ended. I mean, imagine if every European, when the Muslims entered Spain and then they came to France, and then, you know, Charles Martel said, we're going to just pray and we're not going to resist, you know, and then the Turks came on the east. So it would, and a lot of, you know, I was reading actually Teddy Roosevelt. There's a great quote in one of my books where he says that if Christians did not fight century after century against Islam, it would have become extinct. So I think a way to paralyze Christians today is to convince them that the religion begins and ends with them doing nothing but being doormats. And if they dare do anything, or even vocally now, resisting is considered unchristian and full of and hateful, et cetera, et cetera. So true. Let alone actually resisting violence with violence, that has been so marred in the Christian mind as being part of just war theory.
Scott, I want to give you a chance to hop in on this as well. But, another piece of application that comes to mind for me is simply that those of us that are a part of the church world, the missions world, at the very least, we can pray differently and we can not be naive. I think of what Jesus says in a completely different context. When he says to Jerusalem, you know not the things that make for your peace, or would that you had known the things that make for your peace. And in a similar way, you look at the medieval period, the late medieval period into the Reformation, and we look at that as Protestant evangelicals, and we rejoice in Martin Luther and the second generation of reformers and the post-reformed, and we're so grateful for the contribution that they made. But they were largely theologians, they were clergy, many of them were involved in statecraft, but they were engaged in the work of ministry. Luther, obviously, his background as an Augustinian monk, and we forget that they were able to spend that time thinking the big thoughts because of Christians in positions of governmental authority who were able to keep them safe, maintain the peace. Now, granted, oftentimes they were persecuted and on the run, but the entire system of
Luther's a bad example of that, but yeah.
Well, but in all reality, you know, Luther obviously, you know, saw there as being, you know, the beast and the antichrist, right? And he pointed to Muhammad and the Pope, and he made a moral equivalency there. And I do think we can look back historically and say those are two very different things, because on the one hand, the corrupt institutions, we would as Protestants look back and see corruption for sure. But there is a paradigm of peace inside of Christian societies where the gospel, even though it was muddled for a period of time in history, was also able to survive, whereas the gospel could have never survived except with great resistance under an Islamic ruling and reigning paradigm. And so at the very least, while we are not colonialists in the negative sense in which that's used, we also have to recognize that missions often happen so oftentimes because God in his providence uses states and nations and geopolitics to allow circumstances of peaceful relations between nations so that clergy and ministers can be sent into certain places. And we recognize that we're dependent on the Lord to arrange those circumstances. And we ought not be, you know, the body of Christ metaphor, the hand that says, well, if only everyone was a hand, or the knee, if only everyone was a knee, well, the whole body of Christ needs each other. And those of us that are called to the work of mission should not judge those whose focus is more in the political or in terms of statecraft, because I think God uses all of these things to advance the gospel, even through difficult circumstances throughout history over time.
Mm-hmm. And I would, I know we have a hard stop here, but I just want to, I'd add to that a couple of things. One, it's just important for Christians, especially in an age of deconstruction, where a lot of young Christian young people feel like, hey, you know, I have to be ashamed of the Christianity that I hold to. And some of the things that are being pointed out, look at all these atrocities. Some of the atrocities that we're being told happened just come from really bad history. And it's important to actually go back and study these things. And I think you've been a huge help to us today in helping, you know, give some resources to people that say, hey, this isn't exactly what happened. What you've heard isn't exactly true. In fact, there's a whole nother part of it. I would also add to that, that it lets the Christian minister, especially if someone is looking to work among Muslim people and reach them for the gospel, to know what you're up against and the thinking that's there. And not, of course, not looking side eye at every single person you meet, but understanding the logic, the culture that's underneath all of Islam, and not to just be naive about it. And also, I think all you mentioned some of the great heroes of the past, but also there's other heroes. I'm just thinking about just a few years ago, a couple years ago, 21 Egyptian Christian men beheaded on a beach in Libya simply because they were Christians. And also, I think as Christians, we ought to give thanks and praise to God for men like this who are courageous to their death of proclaiming their allegiance to Jesus Christ. And it also, I think, should also inspire us as Christians. Like, am I willing to live for Jesus this way? Am I willing to die for Jesus Christ this way? So I think as we look at the persecution around the world, I think it obviously can inform us, but also I think should challenge us, inspire us, and humble us, and be a check on our own commitment to following Jesus Christ.
Amen. Raymond, where can we hear more from you? How can people get a hold of your books? And then any other parting words, final applications and thoughts as well, if you want to chime in with that.
Yeah, my website's the best one place to stop, raymondibrahim.com, RaymondIbrahim.com. All my articles are there, links to my books, social media, contact page, so forth. And, final parting words is, I think this was a very good and fruitful discussion. You know, I guess the importance is, really is history. And I think there's a really concerted war to subvert history. Because like I said, if you can change history and rewrite it, then you can get away with saying whatever you want today. And so there's and what I just discussed today, which is, Christendom versus Islam, is in many ways just the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of other historical episodes that have been really tampered with in order to get away with a false narrative today. By and large, I really think people need to catch up on their history, and not just by in the sad and hard. And the sad point is, if you go and grab a secondary popular history, it's going to be actually the sort that furthers this negative false view. So, it's very important, and not many people are equipped to go and read primary sources and so forth in their original languages, but that's part of, I think, the challenge. So at least people should be cognizant that there's a lot of mischief that's been done to our reading and understanding of history.
That is important for folks to know, is that if they pick up one of your books, they're going to be, granted, reading translations, but engaging with primary source material that you cite frequently. And so that's good to know. But if I could just tack one thing on before we break, it's not only that by revising history, we can control the present dialogue. It's certainly that. It's also that the story of history from the dawn of creation, but especially the last 2000 years of the gradual spread of the kingdom of Christ, that tells a story where Jesus is alive, ruling, extending his reign through the spread of the gospel, planting of churches, evangelization of the nations. That tells a very different story, that we're on the winning side and that people must reconcile themselves to the Lord Jesus Christ and embrace him. And if we can undermine that story, then all of a sudden we've lost a powerful apologetic. And so I think that there's a lot that the enemy wants to do to make us forget our history. That's why it's been our theme this year on the show. And we want to know how this conversation has been a benefit and a blessing to you. Go ahead and reach out to alex@missionspodcast.com, or better yet, leave us a positive rating and a 5-star review in your podcast platform of choice, especially Apple Podcasts. We know most of you listen that way. That really does not only help people discover this content, but then we'll take a look at those reviews, and we would love to hear your feedback there. And if you'd like to get access, we have more than 23 overtime episodes, usually recorded at the end of this very show. You want to get access to all of that and a private Signal thread where you can discuss those things among a like-minded group of individuals, and many other benefits that we are working on adding. Go to missionspodcast.com/premium and join the premium subscriber family. Thank you for those of you who are supporting the ministry at $9.99 a month. We appreciate the work that you're doing. And until our next conversation, go make disciples of all nations.